Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, a show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Villanueva, and alongside me, as always, is my good friend and monkey enthusiast, Mr. Spencer Williams.
I'd be real careful with that.
I know. I was like
a split second off from racial discrimination.
We were about to get canceled real
during
quick.
Black History Month, nevertheless.
I mean, it's
wouldn't be surprising.
Yeah. Anyway, speaking of which, in terms of celebration, we are actually bringing to us a whole new individual. As before, you may have known her as Junior Filmlosopher Sarah. Now she is Filmlosopher intern Sarah, as someone has celebrated a recent birthday and has moved on up. So, welcome to the show, Sarah, and congrats.
Welcome to the East Side.
The East Side?
There you go.
Wow. Wait, how do I have Filmlosopher in front of intern? Wouldn't I just be a junior intern?
You're technically just an intern now. So you said
Filmlosopher intern.
Well, because you could be an intern for a company. You're adding a lot to this. We could just bump you back down to junior, where we bring you back like maybe once a year. Yeah, so we have a great show in store, as we are going to be talking about the recently dropped Osgood Perkins film, and that is The Monkey. So stick around as we dive into that and talk about all the nitty-gritty and all the wonderful goresome goodness. But before we do that, Spencer, give us them official credits.
Tune in to brand new episodes each and every week.
Week!
Now on your favorite streaming platforms and on our website at filmlosopherspodcast.com. Also, connect with us on social pages at facebook.com/filmlosophers and on Twitter and Instagram and threads at filmlosophy101. And we also have a Blue Sky.
Blue Sky, that's right. Check us out. We got a website, and our website at filmlosopherspodcast.com. We got allegedly over 300 episodes. Everything from action, anime, comedy, suspense, thrills, and chills. If you're looking for it, we got it. Head on over to our website at filmlosopherspodcast.com. You can also check us out wherever podcasts are streaming, and that's iTunes, Libsyn, Player FM, Audio Boom, Spotify, Pandora, TuneIn, iHeart, and Amazon Music. Tune into your heart's desire on any one of those platforms. Look for us there at The Filmlosophers, and give us a follow or subscribe. And if you like what you hear, give us a 5-star review. We've earned it.
We have.
Yes.
Thank you. We'll give you the rest of the social links at the end of the episode. As I mentioned, yes, we do have now intern Sarah with the crew, as she has just celebrated her 18th birthday and is excited to get things rolling with more responsibilities and duties. She is now on the same level as intern Amy. So it'll be a duel for seniority, I guess, this year as we get to it.
I can't fight.
Yeah, we're going to see how that goes.
I can only take careful on the other junior filmlosophers.
Well, let's hope there's no gladiatorial battles going on.
Let's hope not.
I kind of wanted to jump into something real quick for conversation-wise, because I know we usually talk about things, and it's not in the notes, so you guys are pretty much in the dark on this.
Yes, especially since I looked at the notes
I'm
you wrote, and this
at
isn't
them right
here.
Now.
Yes, they're not there, because I literally been pontificating and kind of mulling this over as to whether or not to share this with you. So I stumbled upon something that's absolutely great and absolutely terrifying at the same time.
If this is another Real Shorts.
No, thank God. It's not one of those. I haven't watched one of those. I haven't been bombarded with an ad by one of those.
Okay.
But I've also kind of steered away from like Facebook videos, which is the most where I've seen them at.
Okay.
So yeah, I've gone through a little bit of, you know, a withdraw from that. But this came across and I was like, this is possibly one of the strangest and maybe kind of wonderful in a really strange and odd way. So did you guys know that during the 80s, and I'm pretty sure after the fact too, Crispin Glover, the man we all know as the father to Marty
George
McFly,
yes.
George McFly in the Back to the Future film, the first one, because he wasn't in the second or third. Mm-hmm. Legally, he wasn't in the second or third.
Yes.
Did you know that during the 80s, when Crispin Glover was at his most crispinest, actually released an album called The big problem is not equal to the solution. The solution is equal to Let It Be in 1989. And mind you, The Big Problem has the not equal to sign. So it's the two, the equal sign with the line crossed through it, does not equal the solution, period. The solution equal sign, Let It Be.
This is already too much.
It is. Oh, we have yet to begin. We have yet to come to the precipice of this chaotic mountain. One of the things I wanted to show you guys. So this album is filled with a bunch of things, including spoken word poems and some songs. One of these songs I just needed to play for you guys, because if I'm traumatized, you guys should be too.
Please, I just turned 18. I can't go into adulthood with trauma.
Now, this particular song is called Clowny Clown Clown.
I was walking on the ground. I didn't make a sound. Then I turned around and I saw a clown. Had a frown. Stood on a mound. Started barking like a hound.
I mean, this video is scary.
So we became great friends, and late in life, got sick.
So
okay, if you didn't show me the video, I'd be like, okay, this might be something I would listen to. Like, just like,
I don't think this is something that anybody listened to, which is probably why I think there's only one album out there. The rest of his filmography for this particular album is just as odd. But this was one of the ones that legitimately actually had people concerned, had me concerned. So he actually, not only did he sing on this one, but he also directed that video that you guys just saw.
Okay.
The album also came with a phone number that you could call if you figured out what, quote, the big problem, end quote, was, and you could tell Crispin what you thought it was.
It was the fact that
he just put
it.
His phone number out
there. He put a number out there. This is back in 1989, so there wasn't really a lot of like disposable phone numbers you could have. Nobody had like extra cell phones lying around. If you wanted a landline, you had to have that bad boy routed somewhere. So I want to know your guys's, specifically, I want to know Spencer's thoughts, because Spencer is probably one of the biggest Back to the Future fans. And now, after the fact, with knowledge and whatnot going, being more accessible and knowing kind of the way he was on set and kind of the reasons why he wasn't brought back for 2 and 3, how does this particular knowledge sit with you?
So this kind of falls in line. There is a video clip of Crispin Glover going on David Letterman, I believe.
David Letterman, yeah.
Yeah. This fits in with that. It's just like,
what does he have? He has a potato chip collection, or what does he have with
that? Don't know. Like, it's like this man is just speaking English words, but in ways that don't really make sense, even though they do, but they don't. And that's kind of what this reads to me as a thing that makes sense, but it doesn't.
Are you actually looking at information about the...
Just looking at the track listings and about how there's untitled bonus tracks back when that used to happen.
Come on, let me know. What are some of these titles that speak to you here? Come on.
Oh, I'm just looking at tracks, but they're all just ridiculous. Like, New Clean Song. Oh, okay.
I mean...
Selected readings from Rat Catching. What? What were we doing?
Because this was well before he did the Wilfred movie, which was about a man who's obsessed with rats that he has.
I vaguely remember that. That seems kind of upsetting. We brought that back up into my head.
Yep.
Never Say Never to Always. Again, things that sound like they make sense, but do they? This is really, this is where he was at the time. Maybe still is. I don't know.
Yeah. Is he still alive?
I don't know. That's why I was like, it's really hard to keep track of like what's going on with people and who's alive.
What are you doing over there, intern? Are you actually in this conversation?
I'm
are
taking notes.
Of what?
Is there a test later?
I feel like there's a test later about the rats.
All right, well, we need to see if Crispin Glover is still alive, because I don't even know.
You're going to call the number live on recording? No.
It was disconnected back in 07, which is crazy that it was almost 20 years active.
So he's still alive. He's 60 years old right now. He's 60 years old. Do you think that families that live around his house inform their children to not go into his yard? Do you feel like he's one of those types of people that would put like landmines in his yard to keep kids off of his yard?
I don't think he's that gone, but like, this is a man I don't understand.
This is the man nobody, I think, understands. Like, this is just so out there.
Yeah, well, that's kind of just what he does now, is just really out there things. I went to his website. Uh-huh. He has a website.
Oh.
I'm going to just turn it around and show you. This is the website.
What is that?
It's like an old GeoCities page.
Oh. Okay.
With a last updated date of 2020.
Okay.
But, you know, just says it's fine. Everything's fine. Part two of the It trilogy. It's fine. Everything is fine.
Is that a new album or something?
I don't know. I have no. I come here offering nothing. Okay, you ask me a question.
No. It's true. I it's this is a conundrum. I feel like when it comes to the nature of understanding people like Crispin Glover, it's very difficult to kind of make it make sense, because his persona in Back to the Future is becoming more and more obvious that that's how he was in real life, ultimately.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he was odd. He didn't make a lot of efforts to being, you know, even socially cognitive, I guess, like aware that there was people out around him. I don't know, man. Like, this guy just really seems to have this thing where he is Mozart and Da Vinci wrapped in one, in a world that just doesn't understand him.
Yes, we don't understand.
Yeah,
like that's the main thing. Like, I'm sure, like, you know, there is a very smart, intelligent man there, but I am being talked to in a way that I can't even really interact with.
It's like when we saw the Wolfman, and when she's trying to communicate to him and it's garbly, and he's trying to communicate to her and it's like noises. Like, that's what I feel like. I feel like there's a special cult of people like this where it's Crispin Glover
syndrome.
Yeah. Yoko Ono and like Tom Waits, who mumbles everything. Like, I feel like these people and Wiz Khalifa, because they all mumble. Like, they're all in that same arena where they think very highly of themselves, and they just go and just talk about how great they are to people who don't understand them, and then receive feedback that they don't understand. Mm. Like, that's like the best, you know, AA that they could find slash, you know, support group slash cult. Cause I don't get it. Like, I'm going to be as kind as possible with this.
Mm-hmm.
People like that remind me of the people who I used to assist when I would go do, like, when I would go and take food to the homeless. Like, there are certain people that you're just like, I get it. You probably did a lot of bad stuff and your brain is fried. So I'm just going to leave this food here, right here for you. And I'm going to walk away while they're doing X, Y, and Z and thinking that they're well in their own world. Like, It's borderline like scary, you know, for people like this. Like, it's like, are you not aware that your brain functionality is quite different, to the point to where I don't think anybody with a sound and logical mind thinks you're right?
I mean, but he's still out there doing stuff.
Oh, yeah, because he's got money and residuals up the wazoo from all of his movies, especially Back to the Future and the Charlie's Angel movie that he was in. He was in one of them.
Yeah, I keep forgetting about that.
Yeah, and that's, I think that's like the most recent movie I think he was in.
Hmm.
And I'm like, how did they do it? Like, how did they? I've heard more stories about Lucy Liu and Bill Murray on that set than I have about anyone else and him on that set. And I know that there has to be stories about him on that set, unless he's got like ironclad lawyers who are just like in like attached at the hip. They're like, remember, if you talk about Crispin Glover, we're going to sue. Like, I feel like that's what's going on in those worlds, in those circles. What are you looking at there?
I'm looking up his filmography because I was like, oh, what was the last like thing he was in? He's in like a lot of TV shows, apparently.
Really?
Yeah, he was in Guillermo's Cabinet of Curiosities.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Do you know what episode?
Does this link tell me the specific one? Episode 5.
Okay.
Pikmin's Motel.
I don't think I got that high in the episode. Honestly,
it was also in American Gods, and that's there's something new coming out this year called By the Rivers of Babylon.
I figured like this would be, since we're going to be talking about a much more illogical but still controlled chaos. You know, mine.
So you brought up Crispin Glover.
Yeah, I bring up Crispin Glover and his foray into his love of clowns. Because the author that we're going to be talking about next was also a fan of clowns in his writing. So this is our segue into the conversation of the evening. Yes, I went there.
Oh my gosh.
As we discuss the recently dropped short story adaptation of one Osgood Perkins, and that is 2025's The Monkey. This movie is one of the more anticipated films for 2025, as many people have been seeing trailers for it for the last year and have been excited about it, seeing Osgood Perkins kind of re-shine his ability to produce great horror films after doing the success that having the success he had with Longlegs. This is an excellent follow-up to that film, or not to that film, but the next in his projects of filmography. So as we move forward, before we get any more into our conversation, Spencer, why don't you give us that official synopsis goodness?
When twin brothers find a mysterious wind-up monkey, a series of outrageous deaths tear their family apart. 25 years later, the monkey begins a new killing spree, forcing the estranged brothers to confront the cursed toy.
Written and directed by Osgood Perkins, based on the Stephen King short story and produced by James Wan, the film stars Theo James, Tatiana Maslany, Christian Convery, Colin O'Brien, Rohan Campbell, Sarah Levy, Adam Scott, and Elijah Wood. A couple key pieces about the film. This is actually based on a short story from Stephen King from his collection called Skeleton Crew, which was first published in 1985. So this story has been around for a good bit, at least we're looking at what now? 40 years. 40 years. And in the due process of all of that, there's a reason why I mentioned 2024 as the monkey, because they actually did, someone had actually already produced a short film adapting this back in 2023. Now, it didn't get a lot of attention. It didn't get a lot of publicity, obviously, because or else we would have heard about it.
Right.
And honestly, it's a three-part short film. It's like 4 or 5 minutes each part.
Oh, okay.
And it's all on YouTube. but it's probably have maybe like 900 views, maybe 1,000 views. And I think many people mistook that for the, because it also has a trailer on the page. They probably mistook that trailer for the actual trailer for the movie this year. So probably, knocked up their views on that quite a bit. So, and I'm pretty sure there's probably other opportunities where people have taken this and have adapted it in some form or fashion, but another key piece of information, according to the director, the decision to have the monkey bang a drum instead of the cymbals, which is in the book, in the short story, was due to the rights to the cymbal banging version being owned by the Walt Disney Company, as the toy had appeared as a character in Toy Story 3. Intern Sarah had mentioned this to me earlier, that this was something that was noteworthy because of the fact that, again, in the source material, it is a clapping monkey, the cymbal clapping monkey. So it is ironic, however, because the cymbal monkey was originally placed in Toy Story 3 in the first place because its director, Lee Unkrich, is a fan of Stephen King. That is the only reason why they put that monkey in that movie. So it comes full circle. And of course, I don't know if you guys know this as well, but Osgood Perkins, as great of a writer and director as he is, as well as actor, he's acted in a few movies. He does come from a lineage of great performances because his father is one Anthony Perkins, the main character from Psycho. So I don't know if you guys knew that, but that's his father.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Which, oddly enough, Anthony Perkins did do some of these sequels to Psycho. He actually reprised his role in some of the follow-up sequels to the original Psycho back in the 70s and 80s. So I think there's like two of them that he's in.
Yeah.
So this is a discussion about the film that we're going to be talking about as we dive into this. We won't give too many spoilers away, but to be honest, this is a movie that's based on a short story that has been out for about 40 years. So we will be as gentle as possible, but no promises. So you have been warned. Spoiler warning.
Yes.
So let's dive in and talk about, first off, one of the first things I want to talk about, obviously, is our experience with Stephen King. Obviously, I think out of the three of us, we're all big Stephen King fans. We were fans when he started reemerging back into theaters with the It franchise by one Andy Muschietti, as well as Mike Flanagan's efforts in the sequel film, Dr. Sleep, as well as everything else that's been done on straight to streaming, such as like Gerald's Game and In the Tall Grass, things like that.
Castle Rock on Hulu, which had three seasons or two seasons.
Well, that wasn't necessarily...
It wasn't adaptation. One of
his... Yeah, it was based on his works, but it wasn't something that was done, but still inspired by.
Yes.
But yes, and mind you, there are still people who are making efforts to see more of his works adapted as of late. I know Mike Flanagan is one of the people who is currently in talks. I think he actually got it greenlit to do the Dark Tower franchise, the books.
Didn't we already do that?
No, that was a movie. He's talking about actually doing a series.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Which Mike Flanagan's the one who did the Dr. Sleep film. Mm-hmm. And it impressed Stephen King well enough to trust him to kind of do him right for the Dark Tower.
Yeah, that's a good bit right there.
Because, I mean, as much as Matthew McConaughey played a great Man in Black, and Idris Elba played a great role in Deschutes, it just didn't work.
Yeah.
So first off, let's kind of talk about where we sit with kind of with Stephen King in terms of what are some of your favorite iterations of adaptations for Stephen King. Let's start with The Intern, because I know she's a huge fan as well. So
adaptation wise, the very first one that I saw was Andy Muschietti's It back in 2017, which I love the direction he took, because it gave me the it kind of gave me the courage to go back and watch the, was it made for TV, It with Tim Curry?
Yeah, the original back in like 93.
Yeah, which that one was really fun, and I have more of a love for that one just for the actors I saw in there, finding them in other projects. But my overall favorite has been Dr. Sleep, directed by Mike Flanagan, because it both honors and respects Stephen King. Also, in some way, gives credit and homage to Stanley Kubrick's Shining, which was good.
Yeah.
Dr. Sleep. Shining, I have some qualms.
the fun thing about Dr. Sleep is actually Dr. Sleep is the first time Stephen King has ever created a sequel to his series. He's never done a sequel up until that point. So to have him revisit that whole universe and give us a follow-up to, you know, Danny Torrance and all that, that was the first time. So having to trust that after, according to him, being wronged with the previous iteration of The Shining done by Stanley Kubrick, it takes a lot for, I think, honestly, for Stephen King to do something like that and trust somebody with that franchise again. But it proved to be fruitful and gave us a great adaptation. What about you, Spence?
Okay. I have a very long history with this man.
There you go.
And his movies. I'm trying to remember which one I saw is my first one. It's either Stand By Me or it's Christine. And that happened to be one of those ones where it's like, oh, Saturday afternoon TV. Yeah. What's on? Oh, this car's killing people. And I can't change the channel because now I'm hooked on and I'm kind of scared.
Yeah.
It's probably Stand By Me because it had the Will Wheaton in it. But yeah, just like, I feel like just like there's a peppering of like just Stephen King movies throughout my entire life.
Yeah.
And, you know, most of the movies are good. There's a few ones that are bad. But like even the ones that are bad are still entertaining. Or yeah. Like even like the what was it? This was like it was a TV series, I think. The Langoliers.
Yeah.
That
yeah.
one had some great overacting.
Oh my gosh. Like yeah, that movie was just ridiculous with the killer meatballs and everything.
Yes.
Which they weren't exactly meatballs, so they look like
they
meatballs.
Look like it.
Early though. Years of CG, they look like meatballs.
Yeah. So really, like, I've always, like, if Stephen King's name on it, I'm like, it's going to be a good time regardless. Oh, how could I forget Maximum Overdrive?
Killer machines and the goblin headed truck and all that stuff.
And that woman who just left the safety of it all to just scream at all the trucks.
Yeah.
We made you. Perfect. Perfection.
That one has Emilio Estevez in it, doesn't it?
I believe so. It also has the woman who plays Lisa Simpson, I believe.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah,
Nancy
yeah.
Nancy Cartwell?
Nancy Cartwright.
Yes.
Cartwright, not Cartwell.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, it was insane.
Getting killed by a vending machine.
Yeah, you can tell which ones are the drug-fueled ones he made.
Yeah.
Ed, what about you? Which ones are your favorites?
I agree. I'm in that same boat. Ever since I was a young child, like, watching these movies was a staple. Like, I remember watching or rewatching after the fact, like it on TV with my family, talk about family moments on, you know, around the TV. I remember watching like movies like Carrie. It was a regular thing to watch these things in my household, as we've aptly discussed about my childhood in this in terms of horror. But Stephen King has always held a special place because it was one of the few things where my family actually followed up with the books as well as the movie. So there was always the books around the house, whether if it was the It book, Carrie, we had The Shining around, we had his anthologies. I remember how excited my folks were when Nightmares and Dreamscapes was coming out on TV as a series. There's one with Ron Perlman, I forget, it's like a Highway to Hell or something like that. It was another made for TV movie. I forget what the name is for that one. There's so many that you become accustomed to seeing it. It's like knowing the fact that this man has been creating just unique excerpts in the history of horror cinema since the early 70s. And to have, as you stated, to have the checkered past, if you will, of, you know, being on cocaine while writing certain stuff, like some of the Dark Tower series, you know, talks about it. Like there's even a whole character he had placed in the Dark Tower series that represented him in that effort of kicking that habit, like, and kind of having a self-awakening. And yes, you can definitely see like some of those stories where it's like, dude, what were you on? And not to mention like the efforts where he's not only written books, but he's written like scripts for certain films, like even the first Creepshow, where he plays Jordy, the farmer, in one of the excerpts, and he finds a meteor and he starts becoming like infected by the meteor. That's a fun one. Even I don't know if you know I don't know if you know this, but in the wraparound story in Creepshow. His son, also known as Joe Hill, goes by the name Joe Hill, currently is the little boy in the wraparound story for Creepshow. So he's the one who's in there. And it's great to see him. But in terms of like where I'm at now, it's becoming more and more of like, catch it while I can, because let's be honest, we're getting to that point to where a lot of these heroes, a lot of these, you know, creative individuals, they're getting up there in those ages. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, you know, those lifestyles, you know, they end up catching up to people. And this is one of those individuals where it's like, you want to make sure that you capture as much as possible. That's why a lot of his books that he's done lately, I've been catching a lot of them, like the Mr. Mercedes series. There's one called Fairy Tale, I believe. That's by him. I have to check now. Yeah, it's called Fairy Tale, mm-hmm. which is another one of his great works that he's recently dropped. And even a lot of the series that he's inspiring, like as you know, intern Sarah talked about, the Castle Rock series, which was only two seasons.
I thought it was three.
I think it's only two seasons.
Yeah. Well, because the first one.
You could look it up because you are, you know, the intern.
I'm also looking at something about Joe Hill to talk about in the conversation.
Well, that's kind of part of your job. You know,
I'm keeping
multiple tabs.
Come on. yeah, it's only two seasons. But still, like things like that, the Welcome to Derry series that's going to be coming back. It'll be the showrunner is Andy Muschietti on that one, coming to HBO Max. like the ones that are direct to streaming, like Gerald's Game, and even some of the influences, as we'll talk about in this particular review, the influences of a lot of those films and a lot of the things that made horror so iconic during that era, you know, how it's influenced people today. So, jumping into this movie, let's go ahead and dive in terms of expectations. What were some of your expectations pertaining to this film? Let's start with Spence.
Okay. I was expecting just something ridiculous because even from this trailer, like there's a kill where a woman jumps into a pool and she explodes, like, but it's just a mist.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't make any sense. And I'm like, oh, okay. So we're just kind of leaving reality behind a little bit. And we're just going to be like, you know, a crazy ride through like this evil monkey that plays a drum. Like, okay, I'm ready for this. I'm excited about this. I was actually looking forward to it, like coming into the year.
What about you, Sarah?
I was really excited because it gave me the trailer gave me the same type of like vibe that the Final Destination franchise on like the story. It made me invest. It made me invested and excited to see it because it looked wacky fun. What about you?
Oh.
you're like...
Seemed very like, surprised.
Okay. But yeah, like for myself, it was one of those types of movies where based on that era of Stephen King, there's a roll of the die. You don't know which version of Stephen King you're going to get in terms of writing.
Mm-hmm.
And of course... adaptation is always in the eye of the director. You know, however they're going to flesh out this adaptation, it's going to be their vision, coupled with obviously what you get from the story. But the source material, the source material is one of those things where you're like, all right, are you pulling from a coherent Stephen King or is this like Maximum Overdrive Stephen King? Like, yeah. I'm just saying, like, let's be honest, you know, nose candy can make people go nuts, you know? So I was concerned about like, not concerned. I think that's too much of like a, you know, difficult word. I think I was more just curious because overall I was excited about this movie.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't had an adaptation on the silver screen in a while since the last It film. Mm-hmm. Which was in 2019.
Yeah, 2019.
So at least 4 or 5 years. Yeah, we were due for one to come back, and it was absolutely something that I don't think anybody was willing to miss. Plus, I mean, that trailer was just so chaotic.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think anything could have prepared us for any kind of chaos other than that trailer.
Mm-hmm.
The sense of coherency in that was just nuts. So, but overall, like I was ultimately excited. Like, again, it's one of those movies where I've seen Long Legs. I kind of see the manic mentality of where Osgood Perkins's brain is at when it comes to horror. But also I've only seen one of his movies. I don't think he's done any other, he hasn't directed any other major motion films. So I don't know if there's like a pattern set as far as like, you know, the expectations of tropes, the expectations of, you know, Perkins-isms kind of things.
Right.
So to come into this, it's like, okay, this was hopefully going to set the tone for what we would come to expect as what Osgood Perkins pulls from when he thinks what makes a good horror movie. Yeah. Do you see anything in there?
I had to very quickly look up what he did as a director. He's done six things. Five of them were movies, including this one. Wait, one, two, three, four, five. Yeah. Five are movies. One's an episode of Twilight Zone.
So what were the other movies?
So he did The Monkey, Long Legs, Gretel and Hansel. I Am the Pretty Thing That Lives in the House, and The Black Coat's Daughter.
The Black Coat's Daughter, what is that?
I don't know. Some movie from 2015. Who's in this? Emma Roberts is in this movie. And where is this? During winter break, two students stay in an all-girls boarding school in the company of a terrifying presence. That's what I got. But anyway, I think for me, I think we did review that Gretel and Hansel movie. Yeah, because this one looks familiar. This is the one we did where, like, yeah, it was Sophia Lillis. Okay, yeah, so I saw this movie and I was like, okay, this is good. Coming into this, this was just, I wasn't really sure what he was going to do directorial-wise, you know? Because, like, I didn't realize he made this one, so I was like, I have no idea where he's going to go.
Yeah, we saw the Gretel and Hansel one.
Yeah.
So the I am the pretty things that live, whatever, that's a TV movie.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
And then The Black Coat's Daughter. I don't.
So the thing is, I've been recently watching a Shudder exclusive.
James Remar's in that one, by the way.
I've been watching a Shudder exclusive series called Horror's Greatest, and it sounds like, I think they mentioned it in one of the newer episodes as a hidden gem. I'm pretty sure it's one of those, because reading the synopsis, it sounds like they talked about it in there. I'm making sure.
Was it? Oddly enough, yeah, we did review the Gretel and Hansel film.
Right.
Which kind of gives a little bit more credence to where this film's mind is at. Like, I feel like Gretel and Hansel seemed very in the vein of, like, what you would expect from, like, an Ari Aster or even, what's his name? The director who did the, why am I drawing a blank? The one who did The Witch. Robert.
The one who didn't he do Nosferatu?
He did do Nosferatu. Robert Eggers.
Yeah.
It very much in that vein.
Yeah, actually, I was kind of thinking whoever did The Witch did it. Gretel and Hansel.
So it's funny now that I realize that there are a couple of correlations between the two. Once we saw this film and remembering that one as well, which we'll dive into. But let's go ahead and talk about first impressions. So we all saw the film. We engorged on all the gore and we left the theaters. What are your guys' first impressions? Let's go ahead and start with Sarah.
Woo. Leaving the theater, it met my expectations. It didn't, like, there wasn't a beat in the movie that made me be like, I'm not too sure about where the story's going. It carried a lot of the Stephen King spirit and isms that, like, I've grown accustomed to in going through his movies, like movies at, like, The Adaptations. Uh-huh. Overall, the performances and the gore, like, gore crafted not to be like, oh, like, let's make you uncomfortable, but having a, like, a purpose behind, like, it's not just for, it's crazy for the MacGuffin of the monkey and its killing that we are experiencing.
All right. Well, you know, that's our review for today. Thanks a lot, Sarah. Spencer, your first impressions.
Okay. So there's a lot I like about this movie, and a little bit I'm like, I feel like this movie should have pushed the envelope just a little bit more. Just a little bit, because I feel like it would gel just a little bit nicer, because like a lot of this movie, like for lack of a better comparison, like I feel like it kind of is like a Maximum Overdrive of like,
yeah,
you know, kind of like that level of insanity.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then sometimes I feel like the movie kind of like does a little bit of a tone shift to where I'm like, oh, well, now I'm sad now. Why did you make me sad? This doesn't seem like what you wanted to do in the first place. So like, totally, like for me, the movie felt kind of all over the place, but maybe I was having an off day.
Yeah.
I also, this is a truth story. Oh, I also was like watching this movie and I'm like, could they have not picked two child actors who do not look anything alike?
That was, they really wanted to make sure that you knew which one was Hal and which one was Bilbo. They're just like, we gotta make one of these guys just look like he wouldn't be around Hal.
You do know that?
Yeah, I do know now. They're the same person.
They're the same person. But it's funny. Yeah,
because when the adult guy comes to play Hal, I'm like, oh yeah, they should have done this. I don't know what was happening with me. It was really off.
I can see that. I'm just like, what?
When his kid looks at those photos of the two kids, like, they were twins? And I'm like, they
there's no way you could have drawn that guy. They did a little too good on making him different. But yeah, I mean, I'm actually interested in like exploring that thought process, if you will, about wishing it had gone a little further. I'm kind of wanting to know exactly where. We'll talk about it in a sec. Mm-hmm. In terms of my first impressions, like, first off, it didn't disappoint. I can say it off the bat. It did not disappoint in terms of what I was expecting, and it definitely surprised me in certain areas and certain tonal shifts. I absolutely had fun, and at the same time was kind of interested in what the thought process was in taking certain approaches. But overall, I think it was a good, you know, outing for Osgood Perkins to use this short story as a vehicle to do what he did. And we'll talk about what he did in this movie in a little bit. But before we do, let's kind of jump into some of the performers in this film. Man, I'm getting some burpage. Obviously, some of the main performers in this film, Theo James, who plays both the twins, both Hal and Bill. He does a really great job of doing that juxtaposition for both of these guys. I feel like this guy could be a dead ringer for James Franco.
Yeah.
I wasn't sure if I was the only one who saw that, but especially when he did the Bill part, he definitely looked like wherever James Franco is at currently, because he's gone off grid, as we know. But yeah, like I feel like he did a really great job creating that dichotomy of both sides of each twin. And surprisingly, like I'm not too sure where all I've seen him do work in. But of course, everybody knows him from the Divergent series because he was four. Tobias in that one. Tobias. He actually was in the X-Men 97 series.
What?
I'm checking right now.
Wait, what? I did research on one of the actors because I'm like, he looks familiar.
Who? He played Bastion and one of the Sentinels.
Ah.
Sarah doesn't sound too impressed.
Anyone can be a Sarah.
I'm like...
but, I mean, the effort that he put into this movie... And the narration as well. Like, there are two different tones per twin. And I feel like as the progression and kind of full arc, if you will, of where both of those boys started out with at the beginning and where they end up when they're adults, like, he lands those arcs pretty well as far as, like, this is the character, this is who they are, this is what they've become. What do you think?
I super agree. For the adult version, I feel like, you know, did a good job on like separating the two. Very easy to tell them apart besides the glasses, obviously. Yeah. But like Bill had just lost his dang mind.
Yeah. Oh yeah. And he went James Franco.
Yeah. Like James Franco is like definitely what I thought of when the second he showed his face. And
oh yeah.
I was like, oh, this is going to go badly. So yeah, no, I think he did a fantastic job.
Yeah. Any thoughts?
I agree wholeheartedly on that because like it sounds really bad that I didn't do research into like before going into the movie because I thought it was James Franco. Like he looks similar and I'm like, I don't really know my actors that well. Is that James Franco? But knowing it's not, I'm like, okay, we good. I'd like to mention Rohan Campbell or mm-hmm. Campbell.
Campbell.
I can read. I don't have my glasses.
Yeah, apparently.
Throughout the movie, when his character Ricky was on screen, I kept squinting my eyes because I'm like, you look really familiar. What have I seen you in? Do you remember Halloween Ends?
Yeah.
Remember the babysitter?
Oh, yeah. The one who gets killed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Same dude.
You understand that he also plays his twin brother in this one, too, as well. The kid that was sitting in the living room in the army gear.
That was a different person.
Nope.
Listen, this movie is pushing my ability to identify people.
Yeah. It's just the movie of twins.
Yeah. His brother's name's Thrasher. Because he says, Thrasher, do you have any bullets or do you have any of this?
Hold on. It was a different person.
No.
It was Beauchamp's. Because look at this. Look at his face.
Because I don't know what I'm looking at.
Look at this face. This looks like the face of the military man sitting in the chair.
Possibly. Maybe.
Because
who knows?
This is also what the mom said to Ricky. But you know what I'm saying.
Who knows? You're the one who's seen this twice. So
I saw it twice and I'm like, I'm pretty sure that...
So why did you want to highlight that actor other than just to point out that he was in another movie?
I want to point out that I was in another movie, not gonna lie.
That was it?
For the actors, Tatiana was my favorite. Tatiana and Elijah Wood were my favorite support.
So we haven't gotten that far yet, but oh my gosh. So
I'm sorry?
So Tatiana Maslany was actually really great. If you're not sure where that name... it sounds familiar. She played She-Hulk in the She-Hulk series.
I also thought she looked nothing like the woman who played She-Hulk in the She-Hulk series.
The time has gone on. I'm pretty sure they also added a little bit more, you know, to make her look older. But she played a great, like...
She played an insane mom.
No, she played a great single mom.
Yeah.
And I say that not to, like, put... her like on blast in court. I mean that in like all the best ways. She played the single mom character to how you would expect like single moms to rock. Like, yes, questionable methods of parenting, but at the same time, you're one person who has to play both mom and dad.
Okay, I'm not even talking about the parentings. I mostly have an issue with that whole cemetery sequence where she's just like,
oh, yeah.
You know, everyone's going to die. You, me, everyone, you know.
Sometimes in our peacefully in our sleep and sometimes...
Violently with duct tape.
Like,
lady. And then she followed up with, let's go dance. Like, she was both affirming and be like, hey, like, unescapable doom. But let's enjoy the happy things in life. Come on, let's go dance.
Which I feel like she did a great job tone setting for this movie. But I'm like, that's crazy.
I mean, when you're at that age and you're just like, look.
She doesn't even look old.
No, I meant for the kids. Like when you're at that age and those are your kids and they're, because they were what, like in junior high or high school?
Like 12-ish or whatever.
Yeah. Like when you have twin kids that are that age and you're just like, look, I'm not going to sugarcoat it, dude. I'm probably going to die in a blaze of glory at some point in time or something. And you know what? It happens. Hey, let's go dancing. Who wants ice cream? Like, that seems like the most obvious sense of and most practical sense of parenting ever in the history of parenting. You ask any parent nowadays, like, oh, yeah, told my kid I had a major crap. Totally, you know, was stuck on the toilet for about 2 hours. kid was like, can I get you a stick or something? Like, those are the conversations that parents have nowadays with their kids.
Okay.
Yeah. You got to be careful, Spence. Uh-huh. Yeah. You're going to be having those conversations one day. Watch.
Probably not.
The other performer that I wanted to mention in this particular movie, as we talked about kid-wise, Colin O'Brien, who plays Hal's son, Petey. Petey, I think he played a 12 or 13 year old kid.
He I thought he was older.
He was old. I thought he was 16. He seemed older.
He's in high school. I know that much.
Yeah.
He's graduating, isn't he?
No, I don't think so.
Or he's 17 or 16 or something. I forget.
He's somewhere in that age gap, like age, but yeah.
Yeah.
Words.
But either way, I thought he was a great kind of character for this particular film. In the short story, it's more of a family affair. Like the dad's name is Hal and he has two boys and a wife named Terry. And kind of the story revolves around them and him realizing that there's, you know, this monkey that he remembers from his past. In this one, you know, the older people are the twins. They're the boys who are dealing with it. And Petey's like kind of the only kid in this. And I think like his role in this one was pretty good. I felt like it kind of reflected the mindset of most kids that age around right now.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a good way to interject it into the storyline to kind of update the feel of it. And he was a good actor, you know, for him being a kid and doing, you know, that particular role, he did well. But likewise also, you know, Christian, Convery, who played the young Hal and the young Bill, I think they did well as well for the roles. I think he did, you know, they played the right, he played, because he played both sides of that coin, and they were, as we stated, as much as they looked different, they were both just different in personality altogether as well. One was cocky, arrogant, and full of himself, and a jerk. And the other one was meek, mild-mannered, and traumatized. Like, and the actor who played both of them did it so indiscriminately. Like, it was so much like, this is one, this is the other. And they could have easily, like, had two separate people playing them and probably not get it as well as he did.
Yeah. No, great.
So, phenomenal work. And then, of course, as Sarah mentioned, there were a few, you know, surprises in this movie. One of them being Elijah Wood, who plays the stepfather to Hal's son, which was hilarious. His whole role in this film, he's like a
all the marbles.
Yeah, he's like a leading expert in the field of parenting,
of fatherhood, nevertheless. And
the funny thing is, he has no kids.
Yeah,
like that's the joke. Like you're the leading expert, and you don't have any kids. Like you're literally trying to steal a kid right now. Like there's a whole thing about him wanting to adopt Petey because Hal doesn't see him as much. And it's like, oh, he's okay. He's trying to steal Hal's kid. Got it. You know, and he is a stereotype of stereotypes, between the way he looks, the way he responds to Hal, the water bottle, the picking up of that giant, like 1 gallon water bottle and taking that swig. Like all of that is just so stereotypical of those types of individuals. Mm-hmm. Those like experts in the field who aren't really experts. They just happen to come up with great stuff. It's like
that
one. They
write books about them.
Yeah. And then they write books about it. It's like that one friend who everybody seems to go to because he gave great advice like 10 years ago. And it was about a Halo game. Like literally that's like, come on. He's good, but what has he done lately? So yeah, Elijah Wood is in this one. We also get a great, appearance of the director himself, Osgood Perkins, who plays Uncle Chip.
That was great.
That was interesting. Uncle Chip is definitely, he's a character.
Very memorable.
Yes. who met an unfortunate demise in this one. Mm. But yeah, he's very memorable. He looks something straight out of like the 70s. He looks like something that you would have seen in probably Maximum Overdrive. Like I feel
he looks like he belongs right there.
Yeah, absolutely. And then there was a slew of other performers in this film.
But I do want to point out one, because like from the moment he stepped onto the podium, I was like, what is happening here? Nico Del Rio playing a rookie priest.
Yes.
That guy is excellent at being, I am wildly unprepared and have no idea what I'm doing, and I am making up things as I go along.
It is what it is. The great words of our Lord. And it was also his entrance onto the stage of just, oh.
Yeah. And then during the second funeral, when they brought him back.
Yeah, he was just sitting there. He's like, okay, I'm not going to say anything.
Well, the kid just is like, shut up. He's like, okay.
Which that was a great scene also for the actor who
played. We'll get into those next.
Okay. I'll stick to then shout outing.
Well, hold on. So this particular actor, you have to admit, as little as he was on screen,
he
was still a memorable performer, because that whole first appearance of him, I would have been dying, no pun intended, in that ceremony if that was who was officiating that funeral for somebody I knew. I'm like,
I'd hire him.
What absolutely is this?
I was thinking the same thing. I was like, I would hire him for my own funeral if I could, because that's hilarious.
It's a heads or tails on life. And also the lady who played the babysitter, her character being an homage to Misery for. I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
Okay.
But yes, great rookie.
Yeah, no, he's fantastic.
He was
a real highlight for me.
And the fact that I'm surprised, like, I'm hoping that this particular work he does in this one gets him more attention for future films, because that whole obtuse, like, I feel like he would pair well with the character from Stranger Things.
Yes! I was also thinking that, too.
Like, it's his, like, long-lost brother or something. That comes up. So... Since Sarah's already itching to jump into the story, or at least the film itself.
I was going
to
say a quick thing about Oz being like director. I was going to say, if you really like having directorial people come in as a cameo, you should listen to one of the previous episodes, Lesson 412, Y2K, with Kyle Mooney, directoring.
Directoring. When he's directoring.
Director.
I'm so smart. So
moving forward.
Which words? Goodbye.
Let's go ahead and talk about the story. Now, obviously, as we stated, this story's been out for a while, and Spencer gave us the official synopsis. Goodness. Mm-hmm. In terms of the execution of this story, let's be honest and just say what it is. Osgood Perkins came to have a good time.
Yes.
Like there was no sense in first off. There was no sense in taking the film more or less seriously than this film wanted to take itself. And this movie was like, look, there is no sense of logic in this movie. There is absolutely no form of logic to follow. Everything is chaos. Just strap in and hope for the best. Like, that's ultimately what it was. And all in the most best of ways. Like... Because now that we've mentioned that, you know, he did Gretel and Hansel, and he did obviously Long Legs, and this one, and then whatever that other one, not the Black Coat's Daughter, but the other one. Like, it's now kind of stringing together, like, the efforts that he wants to have in terms of creating stories that stretch beyond what we're used to. Like, taking, for instance, the Gretel and Hansel story, we talked about that in a previous episode, where the whole premise of that is completely based on, you know, what if the story wasn't so much focused on this witch eating them, but actually empowering them to be, or at least empowering one of them to be a strong, you know, empowered woman. Mm. Like, and taking unique, you know, steps towards that. Like, it was definitely a step away from the norm. This took Coke infused Stephen King and took the energy of that into the intelligence of masterful Stephen King and combined them into this manic movie with a slight 70s to 80s transition vibe. Like there's really no other way to kind of put it. Every single instance wasn't meant to be a scare. It was meant to be a laugh. Most of the instances were not serious in this because when they happen, they're so impractical, improbable, and downright bombastic that you're like, what just happened?
Yeah.
Like, it's not even like a, like, it's like, oh my God. Like, this act, you're actually watching. It's like maybe one or two of the deaths are like, oh, crud. But the majority of them are like, what is happening here? Like, what, why is this?
The vape scene was one of those where I was just like, because the character, he just kept saying, oh, that sucks. And then the, his last words being that sucks too was just the ridiculousness.
Yeah, that guy was just on a track going one direction. And normally that's not great, but like here it worked really well.
Yeah, it did. I mean, even in like some of those ones where when the aunt, which we've seen bits of it in the trailer, when the aunt is, you know, getting got, I guess the best way, where she's trying to pull out, like she falls through the stairs in her basement. She gets a bunch of rusty hooks in her face.
Fishing hooks,
right?
Lures too.
And she has to pull them out, which it's not like the music is not like high tense strings and whatnot that make it like so like, oh, something's going to happen every minute. It's like the music isn't that intense. Like she's literally trying to just take them out. It could almost be just a straight up comedy. Mm. And then she goes to check a stove that sounds like it's on and it lights up and her whole head engulfs in fire and she runs out of her house right into a for sale sign. Spencer, if this was in cartoon form, this would be a Looney Tune.
Yes, like 100%.
This movie is absolutely just chaos incarnate. It is practically a Looney Tunes movie done in real life, if we're being completely frank. Because everything about this movie is just so insane, and the narrative that runs through it is pretty unique because we get narration from the beginning to about the midway point of Hal, and then it flips to Bill, and Bill continues pretty much from midway of the last section and narrates from that back up to current day really quickly. But we have both mindsets, both kind of points of view are kind of spoken. And Theo James does an absolute great job of that, of creating those two personas very distinctly. And yeah, I mean, this movie just loses it with every effort of what it does. And honestly, I want to say like the fact that Osgood puts in so many homages to what he loves and what he sees as influences for himself in this movie that you're like, okay, you know, I see that. I totally get that. I appreciate that. I think you, Sarah, were mentioning a few of the nods and homages that he was making in this movie.
Yeah. Their babysitter's name was an homage to Kathy Bates' character in Misery, which was Annie Wilkes. I was talking about it with someone else. That,
by the way, that's where you say it. That's when we get to that point. Not like when you're trying to say it over there.
You see, it's been a while. It's been my film and literature class.
Yeah, too much.
Another thing I picked up on my second viewing was later on in the story, we have a scene with Bill and he's looking at the monkey and you have the kind of Kubrick-esque stare that Theo James gives so wonderfully that I'm just like, oh. And I don't even know if that's an homage to Shining, but it looked like the Kubrick stare.
Well, and you can tell like Osgood Perkins pulls from, you know, just Stanley Kubrick in general, because even there's a scene where it's kind of like this traveling through this kaleidoscope kind of thing. And,
oh, yeah.
And if you watch that, it's very similar to the scene that Stanley Kubrick does in 2001: A Space Odyssey, where, you know, he's, you know, going through that, you know, a kaleidoscope kind of tunnel. Mm-hmm. And mind you, there's a ton of homages in this movie. I mean, other than that, like the whole idea of using, so the name Hal is actually the father's name, in the original story, but the kids' names, they're not really in this. So utilizing like, Bill, I don't know if Bill's one of the names, but even so, like using like the name Bill, whether if it's an homage to like it, the efforts to recognize like, the name of the place is Casco, but like, you know, you could even kind of put like a spin on that. Like it might be Castle, like Castle Rock, which is kind of the main place where a lot of Stephen King's stories kind of take place and around. This fact that it's done in Maine, is another Stephen Kingism. There's a lot in this that really kind of draw to it. You know, even some of the effect work and some of the stuff that we've seen, it just intensifies what we see Osgood doing as a director within horror. And the fact that, you know, he not only pays homage to the greats that come before him, but he's also incorporating them into a way that's uniquely his. So
very true.
Yeah.
Any other thoughts on the story from you guys?
I was having, like, again, conversation with another person, and we came to an agreement on that while the movie is, like, just a wacky fun, like, everything's chaos, woo, there's also the undertones and conversation on generational trauma passed on from father and son that you could kind of use the concept and the MacGuffin of the monkey being a symbol for that, because I don't even know if it was talked about in the movie that Bill and Hal saw, like, if they saw their dad at all, or if he, like, because it's stated in the movie that the dad just straight up left. And still with that, you have both in the beginning, Adam Scott portraying the dad telling the guy at the pawn shop, it's not a children's toy, don't call it a toy. And you find later on in the movie that both Bill and Hal say that to other people. But you're also seeing how that affects the characters around them, and how trauma in any form, like, it spreads and it causes chaos and hurt to people. Mm-hmm. Sorry. Burp. That threw me off my tangent. Wow, I completely lost my train of thought.
No, but it's true. Like, there is a sense of recognizing that whole mindset of generational curses that this film talks about. Obviously, like, when it comes to most of Stephen King's novels, they deal with generational curses. Sometimes it's like legitimate curses themselves, but ultimately the sins of the father kind of mindset. You look at any of them, and it's usually like, you look at Carrie, you look at Christine, you look at It, you look at any one of these, you know, The Shining, those things that afflicted someone prior to them is passed down to someone else, or something that they were affected by because of what had come before them, whether it's people or entities, is something they have to face later on in life. Like, the whole idea of revisiting that trauma for the sake of either overcoming it or succumbing to it is kind of in that wheelhouse of what Stephen King creates. That's ultimately his MO for a lot of his stories. And this is one of those where, again, through the, in the throes of, you know, Stephen King dealing with his own trauma, you know, and learning to fight it and overcome it, it makes sense that it's kind of one of his overarching archetypes, if you will, for most of his stories, you know? Mm-hmm. But even in, like, again, you know, that mindset as well of like coming of age, dealing with trauma, dealing with not just generational curses, but dealing with trauma. I mean, that goes all the way back from like, from Carrie, you know, where Carrie has to learn to face her own mother in the throes of, you know, that curse, that trauma that her mother puts on her all the time. You know, Christine, you know, the main character has to face the trauma of, you know, not being, you know, not allowing this entity to continue to kill the people that, deems unworthy based on him, like creating that symbiotic connection and removing it for the sake of, like, you know, being codependent on each other. And even if you look at, you know, Stephen King's work, The Body, which is, you know, adapted into Stand By Me, you know, the boys going to see a dead body is kind of like that coming of age story. And we kind of get that with this, where the boys at the beginning of this film have to cope with loss, have to cope with losing somebody. They have to kind of come of age at that point and then still deal with that trauma later on in life, which in the story, some of them do and then some of them don't. You know, it's just the nature of the way the story falls out and how he creates it.
We also see the effects of two different people dealing with trauma, because you have, from the funeral, the second funeral scene, you have the basically the massive split and divide between Bill and Hal, and how 25 years later we see where Bill's at and versus where Hal's at, and Bill basically staying in the same place that he was always where, which the use of him wanting to continue wearing his funeral suit and bring that into adulthood. And the thing that I appreciate as kind of like a piece, and like, I don't know if it's a like symbol or further like proving the point on part of his suit is is the shirt that he was wearing when his mom died, which I was telling someone about that. And the use of him still staying in there is not one letting go of what happened. He still resents his brother and his brother going behind, which is also a continuous thing. And now I'm losing track again. But I liked how the story went, and it was very well executed. And I have a theory at the end, but that's for later. Yay.
My thoughts on the story. I do like it. This story posits a very unusual world where I'm just like, I don't know what's happening here, but I'm curious to learn more, even though I know we're not really here to talk about that. For instance, when we move to Maine and there's a death in the house with the adults version of Hal, like, there's a whole team of cheerleaders just standing outside the house, like, yeah, there's the body. And I'm like, okay, this has been happening a few days. We have a cheer team for the death squad? Like, that's fast.
And also, Hal wasn't really phased, which also kind of puts into question if that's how it was when they moved there and dealing with them going to school in that town.
Yeah.
Because also, if you bring that up, I realized that some of the characters from when they were originally with their mom didn't carry over to the other town because they moved towns.
Yes.
So originally I was like, oh, maybe this, because there was a police officer in there. And I was like, oh, maybe it was the Asian girl from school. I thought it was, but now second view. Okay. Now I'm like, it's all adding up. It's all coming together.
We've moved and we've left her behind.
Yeah. Well, actually, for that. But the cheerleaders outside, one, two, the realtor, because like she acted like she knew him.
No, she was just flirting. It's one of those things where when you come to a point where you realize that if you've lived in a small town long enough, there's not enough men people. Or women. There's not enough people to really kind of find your prince or princess charming, whatever. So for her and him being from out of town, more than likely, the fact is like she probably saw him and like, oh, he's cute. Which is exactly what happened in there.
You're the complete opposite of your brother. Who's okay, his side.
But like, let's go back to the beginning of that scene where like him and his son are in the car and like they have that little like, that's wild. Yeah. That's wild if that's what was happening there.
And that's the greatness of like Osgood Perkins writing that kind of comedic element into the film to be like, who does that? Like, and who sticks around to hear all that? Like that woman should have been like, yeah, I don't know if that's really information for me to know, but she just like, so no business card. Okay. And it's like, no, like The fact that this story, this movie is littered with elements of just satirical humor and just comedy like beats that don't make usual sense for a good, and I'm saying this for a good comedic kind of horror film from Stephen King. It's unheard of, and yet it works. You know, and the fact remains is that because it works, it is a whole different breed than what we're used to with adaptations from him. And that's just one element. It's just like to have them cheering outside. Here comes the body. Yeah. Like Casco. They're like literally.
I think they want to be known as the city of like, they're like, hold on. All the other cities in Maine and all the small towns, we need to make sure we have our mark and people want to come here because all these deaths, like it really puts into question if actually this entire time they're just like, oh, another drowning. That's sad. Freak accident death. Oh my gosh. We're going to put ourselves on the map with this one. Like,
I don't know. That realtor seemed a little too excited about how many people had just passed away that week.
She was smiling. She had the whole numbers. Time.
Well, I mean, she's also trying to sell that. She's I mean, if you've met real estate agents, and let's be honest, I think have out not. Of all
I'm just 18 now.
I think, you know, Spencer has probably met the most out of any of us because of what he does for a living. And stuff.
I declined to comment for various reasons.
But okay, I've worked with real estate agents in my career. They are some of the most plastered, smiled people that I've ever met who show up and know how to turn it on for the sake of a sale. And when it comes to trying to get something moved or sold or convinced, like she was like, huh, he's cute. I could take him home to my trailer park. Like it was like some of those mindsets where you barely caught on to that. It was like one of those things where it's like, she's trying to sell something, either the house, you know, herself or something. Like she was on to something.
I caught that there was something going on,
but it's
just too much at once sometimes in this movie.
And I feel like the sense of her, like the whole scene is just riddled with satire because even her makeup made her seem like disingenuous. Like it looked like it was too white. The makeup was done kind of like how you would put on like a doll or something. She seemed very interesting in the way her makeup was done. So it seemed like, maybe, I don't know, but that added to the kind of hilarity of like taking her seriously, which I did not take her seriously at all. And the way that scene falls out, and it's like it happens, and he's just standing there, and his son's downstairs, like, is everything all right? He's like, it's all good. And it's like, dude, someone's head just went bye bye. Like,
but that also makes sense for this character because he's just dealt with this like random death thing that just happens at any time during his
only
life.
Only twice.
Wait, no, because before
no,
that.
No, three times. Because it was the first time, which was the babysitter, then his mom, and then his uncle. That was it. Like the uncle is like, if something's bad, boom. Like the abruptness of that was just it was hilarious. Perfect.
It was so great.
It was just like. They turned it and then it was just like the just immediate bong, the picture, which that picture, like, it deserved picture. To be framed.
It's his,
and left
it's
there.
By the way, it's his IMDb photo.
Yeah, right I now. Was looking at that. I was like, he understands that that's a fantastic.
He knows that's what the fans want. He's just like, frame it.
In terms of highlights or issues, you were mentioning, Spencer, that you were kind of hoping, I guess, that it ramped up in certain parts or something. You mentioned this earlier. I need to know what this is about.
No, this is just, it's a minor thing about like,
it's the not tone. Minor because we've been waiting all show and I've been trying to find a way to fit it in. So you're better darn well say
speak
something.
No.
No, I wish there's more flowers at the funeral. That was it.
Oh my God. I would end the episode right now. No ending, no music, just click.
No, it's just like, okay, this is like, I feel like this is a for me problem, but like the tone shifting in this movie, like sometimes you're just taken aback by what's happening that like you kind of miss, like the whole real estate agent thing.
Yeah.
Like I did not take her as like genuine at all, but like just like she was here and then just gone. I'm like, like, I feel like she was trying to talk about something else, but like my brain didn't have any time to process it because I'm like, you're about to die, lady. You don't even know what's happening. Like, I'm trying to, like sometimes, like, this movie, it feels like I have to, like, very quickly figure out where the movie is trying to go with, like, a certain intention before the scene is over, and I have no idea what's going on. Like, for instance, another one where, like, the tone shifted and I was like, oh no, was at Funeral 2. With the mother. Where, like, what's his name? Bill. Bill's just like, funny prank, Bob. Ha ha. And I was like, oh no, this is now actually sad.
There was
this
someone, like, in my sad who awkward. Laughed. He was like, huh? I'm like, oh. I'm like, now's not the time, buddy. Now's not the time.
I know.
But it's like, it's one of those instances where you're like, this is so awkward that if I laugh, I know I'm in the minority, but then I know everyone else is messed up in that kind of way, so they probably all want to laugh, so I'm not in the minority. Like, this is one of those awkward moments where you know you shouldn't, but you probably feel like you have to laugh. Because it was just like, she's dead, bud.
Yeah.
Like, she's gone.
No, that is exactly
like,
how
like,
it was.
And the way it sets it up is perfect. It's like, shut up. And then the priest is just like backs away, like, oh, okay. And it's like, and he's doing this, and you're like, oh, no, bud. No. And then he's like, oh, okay, you can keep going. And it's like, oh my God. Okay. Like, I feel like Osgood Perkins takes the opportunity to wrap those awkward moments. Like, let's as Inigo Montoya says, let's go back to the beginning. when you have Adam Scott, who of all people, Adam Scott,
yeah.
Who is
did not know
like his comedic timing is impeccable. He's hilarious as just the awkward person, and he's there, and it's like he's trying to sell this monkey, and the nature of how everything, you know, ends out, and the thing pulls back out of that guy's stomach, and it just comes with the intestines, and he's like, hot dogs. It's like oh my God, like, I shouldn't laugh at this, but I'm laughing. And he's outside of a theater that says streaming, and it's like, okay, I get what you're doing there, like, okay, streaming movies versus this movie in theaters. And he's got a flamethrower from a pawn shop, and he's trying to destroy this monkey. And that's the last we ever hear of Adam Scott. Like, the nature and logic, and Sarah put this in perfect perspective. The monkey in this movie is absolutely a MacGuffin.
You
don't know where it comes from. You don't know what its purpose is.
And it also doesn't really matter either.
No, it doesn't. It's just literally there to mess up everything.
Mm-hmm.
All it needs is, like, you know, a little push to quote, you know, the Joker from The Dark Knight. You know, all it needs is just like gravity, just needs a little push. Like, that's what it feels like this MacGuffin is about. Like, it just takes one person to do something and it'll mess things up. And it works on a very delicate balance that nobody understands. And even at the point where that balance gets interrupted, and everything goes to hell in a handbasket by the end of the film.
Yeah.
And it's absolutely insanely wonderful and chaotic at the same time.
Yeah, this movie is nothing if not chaotic.
No.
How do we feel about the callback of the skydiving with the weddings? They do weddings. How do you feel about that bouquet toss?
Again,
I was excited.
Yeah. It was like, you're next.
Yeah, the chaos of this movie is all over the place. Sarah, do you have any highlights or issues with this movie?
My highlights is the bowling ball. I love the bowling ball.
We'll just leave that at that, because that's literally like the climactic point of the movie. So we're gonna yeah. As far as highlights for me, like, I loved the score and composition of this movie.
Hmm.
Like, I loved the musical elements of this. I loved the sound design of this movie. Again, and it's been said over time, the best way to determine if a movie is a comedy or a horror is by the music. You can literally change the trajectory of any film and may have it become immediately a comedy because of the music, or you can have it be a horror film on the, based on the music. We've seen it with people who do like redubs or remixes of old trailers of stuff, and like the Mary Poppins trailers.
Scary Mary.
Yeah. Good. So with this one, this movie does an absolute masterful tightrope walk of maintaining both a comedic element without losing its horror persona. It walks this line of remembering it is still a horror movie, but it carries those comedic like bullet points to create instantly moments where you're just like quite literally like, okay, like you don't know what to do. Your body doesn't know how to react as to whether or not it should shudder or it should laugh. And it comes out like that, like, oh, like you're laughing to yourself. But yeah, the composition, the score, the sound design, you got to give credit to this movie because of the fact that this movie is absolutely insanely well done. Let me see. Composer was someone named Ido van Bremen, mm-hmm. Who hasn't really done a lot that I've seen. Mm-hmm. But, you know, either way, got to give credit to the man. Sound design. Let's see. Sound department. Let's see. Yeah, the people who did. Honestly, just the people who worked in sound altogether, because there's so many of them. Like, you got to give them credit. You got to give them, you know, that due, because without them, this movie could have easily fallen flat. So big kudos to that. I had a good time with this movie, and I feel like this movie definitely is one of those ones that is going to be on the higher level of people's lists as far as one of the more favorite Stephen King movies or the less favorite. Like this is going to do what Stanley Kubrick did with The Shining. And I don't think it's going to upset Stephen King as much. I don't know if I'm pretty sure he's seen it, and I'm pretty sure he's commented on it. Yes. Somebody wants it. What has he said about it?
Well, he said it was a good adaptation, and other people around him are like, it's like Final Destination for Stephen King.
Okay.
But the fact remains is that the purists are going to come out and say, well, you know, that's not what the original Thorth material was, more about trauma.
And it's about sweet.
You're gonna hurt yourself.
Yeah,
that.
Look, careful.
It's like material. It's like people are gonna be upset that it's not accurate to the source material. The source material is more about trauma. It's more about this, and then there are gonna be people who absolutely love it, and they're like, "Hey, this is what we got to do. Like, we got to adapt this in this way because modern age, like, I feel like there are gonna be people who are gonna be on both sides, and they're just going to drive that line in the sand so hard that it's going to become obvious to a lot of people. I was already taking a look at some reviews. There are people out there who are like, oh, this was a good movie, but it has no soul. Or this was a good movie, this was an okay adaptation, but it doesn't really go anywhere. And it's
this
like,
this was 2025's Cocaine Bear. I'm like, oh, okay.
But the bottom line is this. It's like, you know what? It's not about what you're comparing it to. It's about what you are getting out of it. And honestly, I had a good time. I had fun with it. So jumping into our special segment, since intern Sarah says she has a conspiracy theory, we're going to jump into conspiracy theory. I don't know if you have one, Spence. I'm kind of giving this kind of room for wherever Sarah's head is at, because apparently she has a conspiracy theory about this film. So let's go ahead and hear what you got.
It's more of a speculation and going into.
Oh my gosh!
Oh my gosh!
She's like, ruined the thong already.
Ah! It was like, okay, wait, I had to. Hold on. Do I have one?
Where's the boo?
There you go.
Okay, I thought you were gonna do the boo from Princess Bride, but no.
I probably should have. This is like Rocket Raccoon is like, oh, you have 70% of it or 7% of a plan. That's not a plan. Like, okay, give us your. Whatever it is that you have.
So towards the end of the movie, we see.
And that, hold on. You're not going to give anything away in this, are you? You are.
Look, says yes.
Never mind. My conspiracy theory is the monkey is secretly in cahoots with the man in black. There. Makes no sense, but think about it. What's your theory?
I don't know enough about the Man in Black to even comment on this.
You don't need to know that that's preposterous, because that doesn't make any sense. It's like Needful Things is another story that's, you know, done by Stephen King. And yeah, no, this doesn't work.
just cut it out entirely.
We literally did a whole segment and it fell flat. Here's the thing. The Man in Black is only just a right hand. He's not. No, that's you. I'm. This is me
frustrated
making a message out of your mess. Okay,
hey,
this is me using the religious lingo that we know. I am making a testimony out of your test.
Oh, testimony. You
know, so look, the Man in Black is ultimately just the right hand man to some entity known as the Crimson King. The Crimson King is somebody who, and this is lore that you wouldn't really know because it's not talked about in main Stephen King lore. It's solely based in the Dark Tower franchise. But Stephen King has stated that the Dark Tower franchise, the universe that it takes place in, is kind of at the center of the universe of all of his stories. So every single story that he's created, the nature of it is tied back to what is in this Dark Tower universe.
Okay.
So in this universe, the world is ultimately ruled by this, or it's not ruled, but it's being attacked consistently by this entity known as the Crimson King, who uses his right hand person, also known as the Man in Black, to deal out his, you know, fury on the people. He also has the ability to travel into other worlds, aka ours, which is where we get his appearance in movies such as like The Stand. He's also obviously been recognized in other elements such as Storm of the Century. That's another one that where it's supposedly him. He's some of their minions, which are entities that are kind of exiled into the outer parts of space, are entities such as like the creature that is it, the entity that is it. There's also other things. It's also kind of where the creatures from the mist kind of appear from. So to give kind of credence to that. So I say all that to say, I'm more than 99.9% certain that this is nothing to do with the Man in Black. However, if the Crimson King created some kind of machination to expel death in chaotic ways, it wouldn't be so much of a reach. You can put the smile.
Goofy little guy. Goofy little jester guy for the king.
But I feel like there's, I mean, ultimately what it could be, and this is probably speculating out of true, genuine speculation.
Uh-huh.
My gosh.
Wow.
Is that there's possibly an entity who got loose where it came from and inhabited the machine that is the monkey, or inhabited or is the maker, if you will, of these particular devices, because maybe there's not just this one. Maybe there's multiple monkeys that do this. And for some reason, Hal and Bill's dad somehow acquired one in like Mogwai fashion. Like maybe somebody smuggled them one out.
Or it's more further than that, because we don't really find out in the movie where the dad got it from. It could have come from his dad.
True, but then how is he just dealing with it once he's older? Yeah.
Didn't
he say that I bought this for my kids? Or like that could have been a lie, but that's what
it was something along the lines of like, I thought it would be like really good to bring back to my kids, but the kids are gonna hate it.
So it could be that maybe an entity is either the toy maker who is imbuing like parts of himself, or maybe parts of the Crimson King into, you know, these devices. Or it's just, you know, the entity itself that is possessed in this machine, which is why it can't die. But then it also, well, okay, shoot. Because then it goes into...
really getting to the bottom of this.
Yeah. And my thing was malarkey and tomfoolery, and it still drives a conversation.
Because I have to find the conversation.
Chaos.
So there's actually a series by Stephen King who co-writes with another individual named Richard Chizmar, and it's a series called Gwendy's Button Box.
Yeah.
Now Gwendy's Button Box. What?
I'm saying yay.
Do you know of Gwendy?
I said yay.
We can hear you drinking in the microphone. Put it down.
I'm thirsty.
My gosh.
It's hard being an intern.
So, in that story, there's a possibility that there's a gentleman who does give Gwendy this box.
Mm-hmm.
And now that I'm thinking about it, there is a possibility that it's either... who is it that gives him the... It's... let's see.
Thanks, Sarah.
Yeah.
Threw that out there.
Yeah.
Just a wrench in his plans.
So the man's name is Richard Ferris.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know if Richard Ferris is another pseudonym for the Man in Black. Mm. Because he gives it to her at a young age. So she's this little girl who's kind of pudgy and like antisocial because people pick on her.
Okay.
And he gives her this box and tells her that this box is going to ultimately give you all the things that you ever need, mm-hmm. all the things that you ever want. And she takes it home. It has buttons. It has things on it. It does all. It looks like the biggest fidget cube you will ever see in the history of man. Okay. And she ultimately finds one button. If she pushes it, gives her a piece of chocolate. And this she can only get one a day. But she comes to find out that this chocolate is ultimately making her lose weight. She pushes another button and it gives her these fat, like dollar, like silver dollar coins, one a day. And she starts putting, like she starts saving them. And it's like all these things that this box does for her, it gives her all these opportunities and stuff, but it also has the potential to create global disasters. And you, as you read the book, you come to find like a lot of it, like what happens and her kind of traversing with that box. Now, mind you, this is a trilogy book.
Mm-hmm.
So I haven't read through 2 and 3. I've only read through the first book. But he does come back for the box in the first book. So maybe that same Richard Ferris could possibly be the same individual who built the monkey in this story.
And placed it into the world and went,
yeah. Well, I like how you're just like...
But specifically...
You're watching me just be like...
My machinations have brought this forth.
Well, well, well.
Now I'm like looking...
Yeah, you're doing a lot of deep research on something that's not the movie.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the unique thing is that Richard Ferris, so there is a slight coincidence that Richard Ferris's initials are the same as one particular character in The Stand, also known as Randall Flagg, yeah. RF, who is a pseudonym for the Man in Black in the franchise. So who knows? There's a possibility. Not that Sarah came in with all this knowledge, but the fact is...
But still, it was affirmed.
No.
Was affirmed on a theory.
That wasn't even...
That was a
meritless and total like lack of evidence theory that you threw out there that I had to find to build it for you. Man, That's my theory. And now I'm taking credit for all of that. Anyway, moving forward for all of this, let's go ahead and talk about whether or not the film passes. But don't shake your head at me.
This was a tangent into madness.
It was. And all because it went from I have a theory to, well, I kind of have a theory to I have 7% of a theory. Well, I have an idea. And then she almost
accusation.
And then she almost went and gave the ending of the movie away. And it's like, we got to talk about your internship.
Had to come in and be Rocket Raccoon in that whole scenario.
Yeah, because I had to give merit to this whole segment.
You didn't actually. You could have just been like, anyway. And you would have saved us all time.
Spencer, does that sound like me?
It doesn't. But saying that it is a path you could have taken.
Again, does that sound like me?
I just said it wasn't. But again, it's a thing that could have happened.
So, wrapping this thing up, let's go around the table. Does the film pass or fail? And how many monocles? Let's start with Spencer.
This movie does pass. It's
after all that.
This movie is just, it's a very interesting tone that this movie takes of just being insane from the get-go, and it kind of like has like tonal shifts of like seriousness to like just abject comedy. It's a lot coming at you at once, and it's one of the few movies where like I'm like, ah, man, I kind of wish we could just start this again here while I'm in the theater so I can just see it again.
Yeah.
So I can make sure I really got everything from the viewing. Because, like, this movie surprises you with, like how the tone works. But it's really fantastic. It's actually quite good. I really had a good time. It's fun. And, you know, there's not a whole lot of movies that are good and intentionally good that take this tone of just, like, I guess they died. So anyway, what's going on with your life? Like it's just really bizarre, but in a fantastic way. So for me, I'm going to give it 4 monocles because, you know, I really did like this one.
There you go. What about you, Sarah?
This film passes for me, even with my wrenching the plans of the podcast.
Yeah. Good first episode, by the way.
Oh,
good
great start of my internship. It really
Spencer,
sets,
we got to talk to HR. I don't know where we keep getting these interns at, but I swear.
Really just sets the precedence for the OG intern to have higher and more, you know, was it?
See, we give her
perks?
One day off, and this is what we devolve into. See this?
And they never hire me. Oh, I shouldn't say that. Wait, I don't have a job. Oh no. It passes for me.
We've stated that already.
You're doing fine.
It has 4 out of 5 monocles. Would recommend to my friends, but then again, they don't take
but
my
just
recommendations.
Friends.
This sounds like
Sarah. That is probably not the best way to put this. I'd recommend it to my friends, but they don't listen to my recommendations.
This sounded like this was going into one of those like news reports of like, sir, did you see the thing? Yeah, I want to give a shout out to little Ray Ray and little John. Hey, bro, I see you. I'm on the TV. Oh, yeah, I didn't see anything. Okay, bye.
This had a real Debbie Downer.
Yeah.
It's like, oh. Blah, blah,
blah. Am I going to have to add this to the soundboard?
You should.
I'll add it to it. No, I've never had a need to.
Yeah, but we can get that ready for your next time you're on the podcast.
Absolutely. It's literally just going to be the Sarah section. as far as my thoughts, the film does pass. It has a great narrative that it actually, as much as you find yourself leaving off on the way the film ends, you absolutely feel like there's closure to the story, even though it doesn't feel like there's closure. I love the way this movie ends, and I want it to stay that way. I hope there's no sequels. I hope they don't do all that because this movie was good. And as far as monocles, this definitely carries the heart of what Stephen King, I feel, creates as a writer, as an author, when it comes to building something that not only is interpreted by many as a great story, but then is adapted by a masterful director who can take that and build something on it, such as like what Mike Flanagan did with Dr. Sleep. This is one of those types of, and Andy Muschietti did with the It franchise. Like, this is one of those new elements of his works where we know without a shadow of doubt that he did a great job. And Osgood Perkins needs to make sure that everything that he does moving forward, people know he can do horror and he can do it well. And I look forward to a lot of what else he has in the future. So
they teased his next movie at the very end of the movie after the credits, which was Keeper.
Keeper. Yeah. So as far as score here, I'm going to give it a 4.5 out of 5. I had a great time. And I hope everyone else who goes to see it has a great time as well. So, but yeah, that about wraps up another awesome episode of the Filmlosophers. Remember, you can check us out over at our website at filmlosopherspodcast.com. There we got allegedly over 300 episodes, everything from action, anime, comedy, suspense, horror, thrills, and chills. If you're looking for it, we got it. Head on over to our website at filmlosopherspodcast.com. You can also check us out wherever podcasts are streaming, and that's iTunes, Libsyn, Player FM, Audio Boom, Spotify, Pandora, TuneIn, iHeart, Amazon Music. If you're looking for it, we got it. Head on over to those places and look for us there at the Filmlosophers. Give us a follow and a subscribe, and listen in. Tell us what you think. Did you get a chance to see The Monkey this past weekend? Did you like it? Did you not like it? Give us your thoughts in the towel section, and if you like what you hear, give us a 5-star review. We've earned it.
We have.
You can also check us out over on the socials at facebook.com/filmlosophers and on Twitter, Instagram, and Threads at filmlosophy101. We're also on Blue Sky at Filmlosophers Podcast. Again, you can check all of our great stuff over at our Instagram page, including all of our special content such as Spencer's Big Score and Amy's Jane on Scene, which can be found over at The Only Place That Ever Lives, which is Jane on Scene on Instagram and Instagram only. We had a great time, and our first official episode with intern Sarah, which we're going to have to give notes because,
I'm not coming back, am I?
Probably not. No. we'll see.
She won't.
We'll definitely talk to HR. But this was a fun episode and absolutely one of those types of movies where as we're moving more and more into adaptations, we need to make sure that we are open to the understanding that adaptation is in the eye of the beholder. And it just so happens that Osgood Perkins has a great eye. So that wraps up this episode. So from all of us here at the Filmlosophers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Spence.
I'm Sarah.
Intern Sarah.
I'm an intern.
Class dismissed.